From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Very sadly, the situation in Darfur continues to grow more grim and more bleak. Today, there was an attack in Jebel Moon area, which is in the state of West Darfur. There have been over 100 civilians killed in the last week from government troops, Janjaweed, bombing from Antonov airplanes.
Darfur Diaries, Stories of Survival. We'll talk with two young filmmakers about their journey to Darfur. Then this weekend marked the 15th anniversary of the Santa Cruz massacre in East Timor. Journalist Alan Nairn and I witnessed the attack.
Soldiers marched straight up to us. They never broke their stride. We were enveloped by the troops. And when they got a few yards past us, within a dozen yards of the Timorese, they raised their rifles to their shoulders all at once, and they opened fire.
Massacre, the story of East Timor. But first, the latest from Gaza. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Democratic lawmakers are calling for U.S. troops to begin pulling out of Iraq within the next 4 to 6 months. The incoming Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, the incoming Armed Services Committee Chair, Senator Carl Levin, and the incoming Foreign Relations Committee Chair, Senator Joseph Biden, all said a phased redeployment of troops would be their top priority when the new Congress convenes in January. This is Howard Dean, Chair of the Democratic National Committee, on Fox News Sunday.
Get ourselves out of Iraq. The vast majority of the American people believe the truth, which is that it was a mistake to get into Iraq in the first place. That the president does not believe. But everybody in America understands that we cannot stay, except possibly the president and Vice President Cheney, understands that we cannot stay in Iraq forever. We can't.
Meanwhile, Republican Senator and presidential hopeful John McCain said more troops are needed in Iraq. He spoke on NBC's Meet the Press.
The question is what's the solution? And I believe that a withdrawal or a date for withdrawal will lead to chaos in the region. And most military experts think the same thing. I believe that there are a lot of things that we can do to salvage this, but they all require the presence of additional troops.
McCain's call for more troops to be sent to Iraq came on a day that at least 159 people died in Iraq. In Baghdad, two suicide bombers killed 35 men who were waiting in line to join Iraq's police force. In Bakuba, 50 bodies were found behind an electrical company. 25 more bodies were found in Baghdad. The Guardian newspaper described Sunday as a day of violence, exceptional even by the country's grim standards. The violence continued this morning when a minibus exploded in eastern Baghdad, killing 20 people and wounding 20 others. At least another 64 Iraqis died on Saturday. Officials in Baghdad announced around 1,600 bodies were brought to the city morgue last month. It was the highest tally since July. In Washington, President Bush is planning to meet with advisors from the Iraq Study Group today to discuss options on Iraq. For the first time, the White House has indicated it might be open to hold talks with Iran and Syria. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, Shia Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki called on Sunday for a shakeup of his cabinet. More signs are also emerging on how the Iraq war has stretched the military thin. The Associated Press is reporting the Pentagon's developing plans that for the first time would send entire National Guard combat brigades back to Iraq for a second tour. Smaller units and individual troops from the Guard have already returned to Iraq for longer periods, but this marks the first time entire brigades of 3,500 troops are being sent back. In political news, a two-way race has developed between Steny Hoyer and Jack Murtha to become the new majority leader in the democratically controlled House. On Sunday, Nancy Pelosi, who's set to become House Speaker, endorsed Murtha over Hoyer, currently her deputy. In a letter to Murtha, Pelosi wrote, quote, "I salute your courageous leadership that changed the national debate and helped make Iraq the central issue of this historic election." Also on Sunday, Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold announced he will not run for president in 2008. In a message to supporters, Feingold said he feels he can best advance a progressive agenda as a senator. A new government report out of Afghanistan has found the number of people killed in the war has increased fourfold over the past year. It's estimated 3,700 people have died this year, including at least 1,000 civilians. The report also found the number of militant attacks in Afghanistan has surged in recent months from about 300 in March to more than 600 in the month of September. At the United Nations, the United States vetoed a UN Security Council resolution condemning Israel's recent attack on the Gaza town of Beit Hanun that killed at least 19 Palestinian civilians and left dozens wounded. One family lost 16 members when Israeli tanks opened fire on their house. Seven children died. The youngest was just a year old. The UN resolution called on Israel to abide by its obligations and responsibilities under the Geneva Convention. It also called on the Palestinian Authority to stop rocket attacks on Israel. The U.S. delegation criticized the resolution for being one-sided. This is U.S. Ambassador John Bolton.
We are disturbed at the language of the resolution that is, in many places, biased against Israel and politically motivated. Such language does not further the cause of peace, and its unacceptability to the United States in previous resolutions well known.
The U.S. veto was widely criticized in part because the United States has repeatedly used its veto to shield Israel from criticism at the United Nations. This is Nasser al-Kidwa, the Palestinian observer to the U.N.
As I said, you know, that the fact that the Security Council did not adopt this balanced resolution is sending two wrong messages. The first one, the wrong message to the extremists on the Israeli side, that they are above the law and that they can continue with this aggression. This aggression has been unfolding in the Gaza Strip for the last 5 months.
Arab League Chief Amr Moussa said the veto was incomprehensible. In response, the Arab League announced it would lift the financial blockade on the Palestinians in defiance of the United States. Despite the international outcry, Israel is continuing to carry out attacks on Gaza. On Sunday, a 16-year-old Palestinian teenager was killed by an Israeli missile strike on Beit Lahia. Three other Palestinians were injured in the strike. In other developments in the region, a deal appears to have been reached between leaders of Hamas and Fatah over a new coalition Palestinian government. Under the reported agreement, a former university official named Mohammed Shabir will become the new Palestinian prime minister, replacing Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert is visiting Washington and will meet today with President Bush. A coalition of anti-war and veterans groups met in Philadelphia Saturday to announce plans to mobilize a national movement to impeach President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. A national impeachment day has been called for December 10th. Activists are urging grassroots groups to set up impeachment lobbying offices in every congressional district. Speakers on Saturday included Cindy Sheehan, whose son Casey died in Iraq.
Right now, at this minute, we have to start calling the offices of John Conyers, Nancy Pelosi, Henry Waxman, Steny Hoyer, Harry Reid, your congressperson, and start saying, we want accountability.
Sheehan criticized the Democratic leadership for saying impeachment is off the table. Meanwhile, a new poll from Newsweek has found President Bush's approval rating has dropped to a new low of 31%. Officials in Havana are praising a recent vote at the United Nations calling for the United States to end its 48-year-old trade embargo against Cuba. 183 nations in the United Nations General Assembly voted in favor of lifting the embargo. Israel, the Marshall Islands, and Palau joined the United States opposing the resolution. The UN has passed a similar resolution for 15 consecutive years. This is Cuban Foreign Minister Felipe Perez.
Our people have won a strategic victory over a policy which has tried to defeat it through hunger and sickness, and without success tried to bring it to its knees. This fills us all with pride and gives us hope in the conviction of how much prestige and support our fight has on an international scale.
In Germany, anti-nuclear activists temporarily stopped a train Sunday transporting 175 tons of nuclear waste from France to Germany. Activists repeatedly block the train tracks to protest the shipment of the nuclear waste. At one stop, two activists chained themselves to the rails. Police removed a total of 200 demonstrators from the railway lines. Over 1,000 people also staged a sit-in near the site of the final storage dump. In Washington, ceremonies will be held today to mark the beginning of construction of a new federal monument to civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. The memorial will sit on 4 acres adjacent to the FDR Memorial and in direct line with the Lincoln and Jefferson Memorials. It marks the first monument to an African American on the National Mall. This is Harry Johnson, president and CEO of the Martin Luther King National Memorial Project.
Dr. King will be situated not far from the Lincoln Memorial, where he made his famous speech. But then Dr. King is looking over at the Jefferson Memorial and talking about the promissory note that we've come to collect on the promissory note. It's all apropos to what his message was about then, and it will be about in the future.
It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds.
And the pioneering feminist journalist and cultural critic Ellen Willis has died at the age of 64. She was the first pop music critic of The New Yorker and was a founder of the feminist group Red Stockings. She was also a professor of journalism at New York University. She is survived by her husband, the sociologist Stanley Aronowitz. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States vetoed a UN Security Council resolution condemning Israel's recent attack on the Gaza town of Beit Hanun that killed at least 19 Palestinian civilians and left dozens wounded. One family lost 16 members when Israeli tanks opened fire on their house. 7 children died, the youngest a year old. The UN resolution called on Israel to abide by its obligations and responsibilities under the Geneva Convention. Diana Bhutto is a political analyst and former legal advisor to the PLO. She joins us now on the line from Ramallah in the West Bank. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Can you talk about the latest news? First, if you can talk about this reported agreement for Haniya, the prime minister, to step down.
Yes, there actually has been an agreement reached, or so we've been told, between the two movements of Fatah and Hamas that are now going to call for the removal of Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh to be replaced instead by a person who is close to Hamas but not necessarily a Hamas member. And the reasoning behind this is both because there's a sense that the government needs to be able to move on, but mostly because of the international boycott that has been waged against the Palestinians, the boycott that has resulted in about 80% poverty in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip now.
Can you talk about the UN Security Council veto, the United States vetoing the Security Council resolution condemning Israel's attack on Beit Hanun, and all that you know about what has happened in that situation?
Yes, I can tell you that I certainly was not surprised at the veto, because if you look at the history of the United States and when it has, in fact, used the veto, if you look at the number of times that the veto has been used, it's been used about 70 times since the U.S. became a member of the Security Council, and more than half of those times that it has used its veto has been on behalf of Israel, either vetoing something that a condemnation that was to be made against Israel, or standing up alongside of Israel in order to use the veto to protect one of Israel's allies. And so it's not at all surprising to most Palestinians that once again the U.S. would use this veto. What is, however, surprising is that this veto is unlike the use of other vetoes in that this is one of the first times that you actually have a statement by the Israeli government indicating that they were, in fact, responsible for what happened. So I'm left a little bit astounded that even in the face of an Israeli agreement that they've actually committed a breach of human rights, that they would, in fact, use the veto in order to not condemn Israel. And so it continues along the same path of just simply showing just how one-sided the United States has become in its support for Israel.
and the significance of the Arab League saying that they will lift the financial blockade on the Palestinians in defiance of the United States?
I think that this is actually a very interesting dynamic, and I think we need to read between the lines in terms of what it is that the Arab League is saying. Because when Hamas was initially elected to the Legislative Council, one of the statements that they made was that they were not going to cut off any aid to the Palestinian people and to the Palestinian Authority because of the presence of Hamas. And yet, aid was, in fact, cut off. And I think that in large part that was because of U.S. pressure that has been brought to bear on the Arab states in order to make sure that this financial boycott, this international boycott, sticks. So it's very interesting that it has now taken the actions of the United States, reprehensible actions of the United States, to use a veto that has now spurred the Arab governments to actually act and to now lift this financial siege that has befallen the Palestinian people. So I think it's an issue that we really need to look in between the lines and recognize that the United States' action is not just simply that of the United States, but it also has far-reaching consequences in the pressure that it brings to bear on many of its allies.
Diana Bhutto, I wanted to ask you about the Human Rights Watch report that says the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, internal inquiry into the shelling of Beit Hanun that killed 19 Palestinian civilians and left dozens injured in northern Gaza, failed to address key questions around the violations of international law and called for Israel to conduct an independent investigation.
There really is no such thing as an independent investigation conducted into Israeli actions. And what was most telling is that an Israeli journalist himself, Gideon Levy, recently wrote an article in an Israeli paper basically alleging that the Israelis are never to blame. He doesn't believe this, but this was the title of his article, saying that there's never a situation where the Israelis are at fault. This is what the mindset is within Israel. And so the idea of calling for an independent inquiry looks good to the outside world. It looks good to Israelis. But when you actually get down to the nitty-gritty of examining these so-called independent investigations, they're never really independent, and they never find fault with, or very rarely find fault with, the Israeli army for the actions that it's conducted. But this presents itself a larger picture. The reason that Israel never views itself at fault is because it doesn't recognize the applicability of the Fourth Geneva Convention to the West Bank, the Gaza Strip. Israel has argued that it is above the Fourth Geneva Convention, and instead that it can act towards the Palestinians in the way that nation states act towards independent nation states when they're at a situation of war. And so what Israel claims is that it's not an occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and because it's not an occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, it does not need to protect civilian life in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Instead, this situation of war. So even if they do conduct an independent or so-called independent inquiry, I'm almost certain that it's not going to come out with the same conclusions that, say, for example, another independent human rights organization would reach, because they ignore the context of occupation.
Tens of thousands of people came out after the killing of the many people in one family, overall 19 people killed in Beit Hanun, I believe 16 in one family. Can you talk about the effect of this, both in Gaza and where you are in the West Bank?
The effect of the protests has been to really shake people and to realize that what Israel is doing is going to continue to happen. Unfortunately, I think the international response, which has been largely muted, has really spurned a lot of Palestinians to feel that they are alone and that nobody really is out there to help them. And in fact, in many of the demonstrations and many of the protests, this was a very constant refrain that I was hearing, which is there's nobody out there that's going to help us. Nobody's out there who's going to protect our human rights. At the same time, as I was watching these protests, I thought back to almost a year ago when almost the exact same thing happened in Gaza, in almost the exact same area. And I, too, was left wondering if we're going to see a repeat of this in a couple of months' time, 4 months' time, 6 months, 7 months, whatever, a year. And then left wondering that why is it that it's these big events that really capture the attention of people rather than the day-to-day killing that's happening. Already since June until today, there have been more than 350 Palestinians who've been killed in the Gaza Strip, and yet it's only the big events that actually end up capturing our attention. It leads Palestinians to a very sad reality that large numbers of them have to die before the international media will actually focus on their plight for freedom.
Diana Bhutto, I want to thank you very much for being with us, former legal advisor to the PLO, speaking to us from Ramallah in the West Bank. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
Willie says there's a story that you may not comprehend. But the parking lots will crack and bloom again. It's a stream beneath the pavement that will never end. Seeds are lying dormant that will never end. Willie says, if you listen, you can hear the sound of birds. It's a song above the chaos, hear their words. It's a song that keeps repeating that will never end. The seeds are lying dormant that will never end. If you listen, you will hear. And the old one sits with me above the city while we watch the madness of the world below. And he laughs and tells me that it's temporary. Underneath the wild garden waits to grow. Willie says.
The singer Tofu, singing his song Willie Says here in New York this weekend at a memorial for the independent journalist and activist Brad Will, who was shot dead by paramilitaries while covering the popular uprising in Oaxaca just a few weeks ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Friday, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Louise Arbour warned that unless the Sudanese government disarms militias operating in Darfur, there will be more attacks like those that occurred last month. Those attacks left over 50 people dead, including 27 children under the age of 12. Thousands more were displaced. The United Nations said in a report last week there are indications Sudan's military participated in the attacks. It said witnesses identified the 300 to 500 attackers as Arabs riding on horseback, wearing green camouflage military uniforms and armed with AK-47 assault rifles and rocket-propelled grenades. More than 200,000 people have been killed and 2.5 million displaced in fighting between rebels and government-backed militias since early 2003. A 7,000-strong African Union contingent is conducting a peacekeeping mission in the region with logistics support from NATO. The UN Security Council voted in August to send over 20,000 peacekeepers to Darfur to replace the African Union force, but Sudan rejected the decision. Our guest today traveled to the refugee camps in eastern Chad and in Darfur in October of 2004. They snuck across the border between Chad and Sudan and remained behind rebel lines. They interviewed refugees living in camps in the harshest conditions and produced the documentary Darfur Diaries, Message from Home. In this clip from the film, a young boy is speaking inside a refugee camp.
I can't sleep all night long. I also can't eat. I have bad nights. I'm always thinking about back home.
All the kids dream at night and cry. You ask why and they say, the planes come. Some of them wake up and run. When you stop them and ask them why, they say, because the soldiers are coming to beat me.
When the Antonovs dropped bombs on us, we ran to hide under the trees. The ones who were not killed ran away. Antonovs killed my father. I saw many people killed. I saw it with my eyes. Many people were killed with him. The bombs severed people's arms and legs, and the people fell. We were forced to leave by army, Janjaweed, and Antonovs. 3 days later, we came back and buried the dead. After the bombing, we came and dug many graves. We used tools and cut wood from the trees to dig the graves. After we buried the people, we left. Even after we left, the Janjaweed and army came and killed people.
An excerpt of Darfur Diaries, Message from Home, the film produced and directed by Jen Marlowe, Aisha Bain, who joined me in New York, Adam Shapiro on the line with us in Washington, D.C. In addition to their documentary film, Jen, Aisha, and Adam co-authored the book Darfur Diaries, Stories of Survival, and we welcome you all to Democracy Now! Can you tell us more about this boy, Aisha?
Sure. He is from an area not far from one of the villages that we went to outside of Musbit, called Hangala. And he was just so striking in the way and his composure of telling these stories about how he was attacked, how they dug graves with sticks, how the Janjaweed came and attacked them even after they dug the graves, and how he has been affected since his father was killed and he is in this camp.
Why did you decide to do this?
I had been working at a small NGO starting in my first year as a master's student. This is 2003 in the fall, before it had even been picked up by the media. And we started hearing reports. I started calling Darfur. I found all these different numbers of people who were giving me reports, alarming reports of what was happening, people being killed, villages being bombed, villages being burned. And we started a media campaign here, calling everyone, CNN, ABC, New York Times, Washington Post. And the message that we got was basically, if it wasn't already being picked up by the media, it wasn't an important enough story. And that really spurred me to continue to try and make someone aware of what was happening. And Adam Shapiro was a friend of mine. We kept talking about the issue. My small NGO closed down. We kept talking, we kept working, and finally he said, you know, I think we should go there. And I said, you're right.
Adam Shapiro, you're well known as being an activist on the West Bank. We just did a segment just now on Gaza. What caused you to go from talking about human rights in the occupied territories to going to Darfur?
Well, as I had mentioned, she had started talking to me about what was happening in Darfur, and I just really felt compelled to do something. Just looking around and seeing what I had been doing in the occupied territories, the recent film I had done in Iraq, I realized that if nobody else was going to do it, then it's incumbent upon us as individuals to try to do whatever we could. And I thought we could take this opportunity, put some funds together, and get out there. And bringing cameras and shooting a film seemed to me to be one of the first things that we could do as a way to sort of shed more light on the subject.
Jen Marlowe, how did you get involved and talk about the journey?
I actually was having lunch with Adam, and he was telling me about the fact that he and Aisha were raising money and trying to make a plan to go to Darfur to make this film. And I guess he saw a blank look on my face, because I had never until that moment even heard the word Darfur before. And as he began to tell me what was going on, I was horrified and shocked both at what he was telling me and the fact that I didn't know, especially because this was right during the time of the 10-year anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. So anytime I was watching the news, I was seeing dignitaries from the UN or ambassadors talking about what had happened in Rwanda or what hadn't happened in terms of meaningful international intervention, but no one was talking about Darfur. And very soon after that, I wrote an email to Adam and I asked, are you looking for a third person on your team? Because I'd really like to be a part of telling this story. So we started our journey in eastern Chad. Well, started in the capital of Chad, N'Djamena, made our way out to eastern Chad, to the refugee camps, talking to the refugees there. We didn't have a visa from the Sudanese government to go into Sudan, so we had to make contact with rebel groups along the border area between Chad and Sudan, and they took us across the border, and we stayed behind rebel lines, and we spent about a month in the area total, some of that in the refugee camps in eastern Chad, and some of that inside Darfur.
You spent a lot of time talking to rebel leaders. Tell us who they are.
We talked to some of the leaders and some of the founders of the Sudan Liberation Army, which is one of the main groups that's resisting the Sudanese government and resisting the Janjaweed. And the one of the main people that we talked to, Suleiman Jumus, was the humanitarian coordinator for the SLA, and he was responsible for trying to protect and get care and aid for all the civilians that were displaced inside the rebel-held territories.
Aisha, can you talk about being in the refugee camps? For our radio listeners, you can go to our website to see some of the images. We're bringing people on the TV show From Darfur Diaries that is now just being shown. But can you talk about getting in?
Sure. We really have to thank UNHCR for their help in assisting us to get into the camps. They are managing one of the most difficult situations that they've really had to in one of the most barren areas in the world. And we were just really lucky that the people that we met were so welcoming and open. And I think when we set out to do this project in this film, we really wanted to represent their voices because the media had largely, they'd been absent completely, actually. And it had been international speaking on behalf of Darfurians. And so we wanted to give them a voice. But what we found beyond anything we imagined was just their dignity and their strength and their courage that they had just come with nothing, that some local Chadians had helped them when they first arrived before UNHCR did. And then they had just, to the best of their ability, they were building their own schools from mud, from whatever they could put together. They were educating their children without any assistance first before UNICEF came in and provided some help. And even so, you talk to them about prospects for the future, and you could not possibly imagine their faces when you said, well, what will you do if you have to stay here longer? To them, it was not a possibility. They were going home tomorrow. They were going home in a week. And they couldn't fathom that now 3 years, almost 4 years after the conflict, they're still trapped.
Jen, the latest news headlines out of Darfur?
The latest news continued to grow more and more grim. I actually spoke just before coming to the studio to Suleiman Jamous, and he told me there was an attack today in the area of West Darfur, a little bit north of Jenina, which is the capital of West Darfur. He doesn't know how many people were killed, but the attack was a ground attack with government troops in Janjaweed, so it's pretty clear that there was loss of civilian life. And this is happening every day now on a daily basis. The violence is rampaging. People's access to aid is getting less and less, especially in the rebel-held territories. There's 600,000 people that within a few weeks are going to face conditions of starvation if aid doesn't get in there.
Norwegian aid agency is closing down its operations in Darfur, citing government interference in its work. It's the Norwegian Refugee Council saying aiding some 300,000 people who fled their homes, they are not going to be able to do it. They've suspended their operations 5 times. What do you feel needs to happen right now?
The thing I think that needs to happen, first of all, people need to have protection. And there's been a lot of talk about needing to have peacekeeping troops on the ground. And certainly that's an important thing to happen for people to be protected. But if the political process is not reinvigorated, then it'll be sending troops into a quagmire, essentially. And there's been very little focus on the reason why the current crisis is where it is right now. And that's because of the failure of the peace process that was going on in Abuja, Nigeria on May 5th. May 5th this past spring. There was a peace agreement that was signed by the government, and the leader of one of the rebel factions happened to be the most abusive of the rebel leaders. No one else signed the agreement, both because they didn't feel like the agreement sufficiently addressed their concerns, and then also it became known as a peace between two criminals because of the two signatories that did sign. Since then, the political process has been all but ignored, and it's only really in the last couple weeks that the African Union has really put some emphasis on trying to reinvigorate this process and those talks. There isn't a military solution to what's going on, either on the government side or on the international side. We have to get people around the table, not just the guys with guns, but the other community leaders, elders, stakeholders, displaced people, refugees, and support a political process.
Adam Shapiro, what does the Sudanese government gain by these attacks?
Well, I think the Sudanese government at this point is to some extent, perhaps even on its last legs. The agreement between the North, between the government and the SPLM, the Southern Sudan People's Liberation Movement, or Army, which was heralded a couple of years ago, indicated, I think, one, a sense of weakness by the government. It was forced by a lot of pressure from especially the United States, but other countries in Africa to make peace. And I think the government started realizing that it couldn't maintain all this fighting with the South. And just when that was happening is exactly when in Darfur we started to see greater violence by the government, perhaps as a way of sort of lashing out and trying to send a message to other areas of the country to let people know that this peace agreement between the North and the South shouldn't be seen as a model for others, that it shouldn't be seen that the government would be sharing power, which I think is a sign of weakness, that the only thing it has left to try to impose its will and authority on the people of Sudan is the military. And I think increasingly we're seeing people reject that, both in terms of raising arms against the government, but also more and more civil society groups and other groups inside the country are rejecting the government of Sudan. And we're seeing different kinds of political leaders emerge, and even older political leaders like Hassan Tarabi, who has formerly been known as a hardline Islamist politician, is starting to come back with a different message this time, a much more moderate message and a message that seeks to unify Sudan rather than fragment it.
Finally, Aisha, rape is a tool of war.
It's used often in war, and here it's really been systematic to destroy the society and the culture that the Janjaweed have been really empowered to go and have used gang rape, sex slaves in front of the men, in front of their whole entire families, children as young as five, even younger. It hasn't all been documented because of the shame involved. Yet it has been thousands and thousands of women in the last few weeks in one area of North Darfur. From one camp, 21 women were raped. And that is just in a span of 2 weeks, and that was 2 weeks ago. It has been increasing. The war has spilled over into Chad. There were 63 internally displaced now in Chad, and the numbers continue to grow in Darfur. Women have been affected. It's completely breaking down the society and the family structure.
Jen Marlowe, you're showing this film tonight in New York and releasing the book?
Actually, we're going to be showing a clip of the film, but we're having, the book has just been published, Darfur Diaries, Stories of Survival, and we're having our book launch event in New York this evening at 7 p.m. at the Pomegranate Art Gallery, which is in Soho, 133 Green Street. So we'd love if people could join us.
Jen Marlowe, Aisha Bain, and Adam Shapiro, thanks so much for being with us and bringing us the documentary Darfur Diaries and the book as well.
Thank you, Amy.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. From genocides current to genocides past, this weekend marked the 15th anniversary of the massacre at the Santa Cruz Cemetery in East Timor. On November 12, 1991, Indonesian troops armed with U.S. M-16s fired on a crowd of several thousand unarmed East Timorese civilians gathered at the Santa Cruz Cemetery in Dili, East Timor. At least 270 Timorese were killed as they sought medical treatment in hospitals. Even with that, more than 270 people killed. The massacre was a turning point in Timor's struggle for self-determination after decades of Indonesia's brutal occupation. At least a third of the population was killed, 200,000 people displaced or killed between 1975 and 1999 when Indonesia illegally invaded Timor. I was in East Timor 15 years ago this weekend with journalist Alan Nairn, and this is a clip of our documentary, Massacre, the Story of East Timor.
And then came the morning of November 12th, the two-week commemoration of Sebastião's funeral. A memorial mass and procession were planned to lay flowers on Sebastião's grave. After the mass was held at the Motayal, people, young and old, came out into the street. And in a land where public speech and assembly had been forbidden for over a decade, they started chanting. The Timorese then held up banners drawn on bedsheets. They had been prepared for the delegation that never came. The banners called on Indonesia to leave East Timor and said things like, "Why the Indonesian army shoot our church?" The Timorese were facing a gauntlet of troops that stretched the length of Dili. It was the boldest act of public protest occupied Timor had ever seen.
More and more Timorese joined the procession. They came from huts and schools and offices along the way. And there was this building feeling of exhilaration as well as fear among the Timorese. And when they reached the cemetery, the crowd had swelled to maybe 5,000 people. Some went inside to lay flowers on Sebastião's grave. Most of the crowd was still outside. And then suddenly someone looked up, and we saw that marching up along the same route that the Timorese had come came a long column of Indonesian troops, dressed in brown, holding M-16s in front of them, marching in a very slow, deliberate fashion, hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
Alan suggested we walk to the front of the crowd between the soldiers and the Timorese, because although we knew that the army had committed many massacres, we hoped that we as foreign journalists could serve as a shield for the Timorese. Standing with headphones on and microphone and camera out in full view, we went and stood in the middle of the road, looking straight at the approaching troops. Behind us, the crowd was hushed as some Timorese tried to turn away, but they were hemmed in by cemetery walls.
Soldiers marched straight up to us. They never broke their stride. We were enveloped by the troops, and when they got a few yards past us, within a dozen yards of the Timorese, they raised their rifles to their shoulders all at once, and they opened fire. Timorese, in an instant, were down. It was torn apart by the bullets. The street was covered with bodies, covered with blood, and the soldiers just kept on coming. They poured in, one rank after another. They leaped over the bodies of those who were down. They were aiming and shooting people in the back. I could see their limbs being torn, their bodies exploding. There was blood spurting out into the air, the pop of the bullets everywhere. And it was very organized, very systematic. The soldiers did not stop. They just kept on shooting until no one was left standing.
A group of soldiers grabbed my microphone and threw me to the ground, kicking and punching me. At that point, Alan threw himself on top of me, protecting me from further injury. The soldiers then used their rifle butts like baseball bats, beating Alan until they fractured his skull. As we sat on the ground, Alan covered in blood, a group of soldiers lined up and pointed their M16s at our heads. They had stripped us of all of our equipment. We just kept shouting, "We're from America." In the end, they decided not to execute us.
The soldiers beat us, but we actually had received privileged treatment. We were still alive. They kept on firing into the Timorese. We were able to get onto a passing civilian truck, went into hiding, but the Timorese who had been with us there on the cemetery road, most of them were dead.
Inside the cemetery walls, Max Stahl, a filmmaker on assignment with Yorkshire TV, had had his video camera running.
The soldiers began at that point to encircle the entire cemetery. I saw soldiers as they gradually moved towards the middle, picking out people who were wounded or taking refuge between the tombstones. And when they got to them, they beat them and assembled them in the back of the cemetery. People were stripped to their waist. They had their thumbs tied behind their backs. And they were made to look at the ground. And if they looked up, they were immediately beaten, usually with a rifle butt.
Max Stahl was filming near a crypt in the middle of the cemetery. Some of the wounded and those too scared to run were huddled inside praying. As Stahl filmed, he buried his video cassettes in a fresh grave. Then he was arrested by the troops.
Whilst I was being interrogated, I observed these trucks driving by with more people in them. These people were clearly in a kind of paralysis of fear. They were not able to move, some of them, at least in the cemetery, and indeed even in the trucks when I saw them going by, were barely breathing. When people are that terrified, it's quite often difficult to tell if they're dead or alive.
After 9 hours in custody, Stahl went back to the cemetery under cover of night, dug up his video cassettes, and had them smuggled out of the country. Alan Nairn and I had managed to leave East Timor a few hours after the massacre. From a hospital on Guam, we reported what had happened to dozens of newspapers, radio, and television outlets around the world.
From Washington, this is the Pacifica Report for Tuesday, November 12, 1991. A massacre in East Timor. Among those injured were two journalists, including the news editor of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York.
They beat me and dragged me over and started slamming me with rifle butts and kicks and punches. And then Alan jumped on top of me, and they beat him very badly. But that was the least of what they did. They opened fire on the people, and these were truly...
日本政府は インドネシアに 真相究明を申し入れ
When Indonesian troops opened fire on a crowd...
This is CBC Radio.
The massacre of 100 unarmed Timorese by the Indonesian military...
Imagine the first
photographs of a bloody massacre during a fight for freedom. This is the CBS Evening News.
In the face of the massacre story, even Suharto's longtime allies were compelled to condemn the killings and came under public pressure to cut back their aid to Indonesia. In Australia, large crowds marched on the capital and surrounded Indonesia's local consulates. The European Parliament voted for sanctions against Indonesia, and the European community later canceled the scheduled trade pact. There were even open protests inside Indonesia, where student demonstrators were beaten and arrested. Back in the United States, the Bush administration continued to ship weapons to Indonesia.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
The only time President Bush mentioned East Timor publicly was months after the massacre, when asked about it by a Portuguese journalist.
A lot of discussion is going on the tragedy in East Timor. We have expressed ourselves in terms of the pure human rights part of it. We pride ourselves, and I think properly so, in standing up for human rights. And I think we've made clear to the parties that are interested there the U.S. position. I don't know
that position to call for an increase in U.S. military training aid. It's called IMET, International Military Education and Training. More than 2,600 Indonesian officers have been trained under IMET since 1975. They include those who planned the invasion and have overseen the policy of mass slaughter. Immediately after the massacre, General Tri Sutrisno, the national commander of the Indonesian Armed Forces, gave a speech to a military gathering. He said of the Timorese who dared to oppose the Indonesian Armed Forces, they must be shot, adding, and we will shoot them. Listening to politicians is something José Ramos Horta has been doing for 17 years. He left East Timor at the age of 25, just before Indonesia invaded. He had been sent to the United Nations to plead East Timor's case. While Ramos Horta got out of East Timor alive, much of his family has been killed.
Yes, I lost one sister and two brothers. The sister, she was 17 when she was killed, along with 20 other kids. Two Bronco aircraft nosedive over a village and blew up the school and 20 kids there. One brother was killed when he was captured. Another, we don't know what exactly happened, but he disappeared during a helicopter assault on a village where he was. But like me, there are many, many other families, and in fact, some even worse. I know families that were totally wiped out. Families that I knew, I grew up with, that no longer exist. I know villages. When all my youth I spent there, and when I ask survivors, I'm told that village does no longer exist. It's not on the map. So this is the scale of the tragedy that was imposed on East Timor with U.S. Complicity.
How do you hold out hope? You've been outside the country for 17 years. You've been the representative of East Timor at the United Nations for more than a decade. What gives you any hope?
Well, the past 17 years that I've been engaged in a diplomatic struggle, I also have a witness, and all of us witness empires crumbling. No one thought possible 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that the Soviet Union would disintegrate into independent states, or Yugoslavia, or the Berlin Wall, the democratization in Africa and elsewhere. And Indonesia will follow the same. It cannot escape the trend of democracy. But apart from that, the resistance in East Timor is continuing at all levels. Armed resistance, one, but also cultural, religious. The entire people are mobilized, and we are very confident. I can state categorically, in the next 3, 5 years, 6 years, maybe a bit longer, East Timor is going to be independent.
Today, Jose...
An excerpt of the documentary Massacre, The Story of East Timor. We'll be back in a minute.
My name is John Riley. I'll have your ear only a while. I left my dear home in Ireland. It was death, starvation, or exile. When I got to America, it was my duty to go. Enter the army and slog across Texas to join in the war against Mexico. And it was there in the pueblos and hillsides that I saw the mistake I had made. Part of a conquering army with the morals of a bayonet blade. And there amidst all these poor dying Catholics, screaming children, the burning stench of it all, myself and 200 Irishmen decided to rise to the call. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side.
David Rovick singing this weekend, honoring Brad Will at a memorial service for the indie media journalist who was killed in Oaxaca. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we mark the 15th anniversary of the massacre in East Timor, I'm joined by John Miller, the national coordinator of the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network, and Shirley Shackleton. Her husband, Greg, was 31 years ago killed in East Timor. He was reporting for Australian television with his team. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! John, what kind of accountability for the massacre in Timor, where more than 270 Timorese were killed on November 12, 1991?
There's been very little due to international pressure. There were a few prosecutions of low-level Indonesian officers. One senior officer was sent to the U.S. to study as his punishment, and people may remember, and there was a lawsuit, and he was found liable. But this massacre and the countless others that have taken place since Indonesia first invaded in 1975, none of the senior military figures, none of the senior political figures have been brought to court.
A report that went to the U.N.?
The East Timorese, initiated under the UN administration, had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which did a very thorough history of what went on in East Timor during the occupation, came out with very strong recommendations, which have been ignored, and we're trying to draw attention to them, that would call for accountability for an international tribunal to bring these perpetrators to court.
Shirley Shackleton, you lost your husband in October of 75, about a month and a half before Indonesia invaded East Timor.
Yes.
In 75.
Yes.
Greg was reporting for Australian television.
He and his team, five of them, went to Balabo because they knew that this is where the hit-and-run attacks had been taking place for a year. They were denied by the Indonesians. The Timorese kept asking for people to come and see for themselves. They went there just simply to do their job. But when they caught the Indonesians at it, they were murdered out of hand.
I want to go to the last report that your husband did.
Thank you.
Greg Shackleton, in October of 1975 in Balibo.
Why, they ask, are the Indonesians invading us? Why, they ask? If the Indonesians believe that Fretilin is communist, do they not send a delegation to Dili to find out? Why, they ask, are the Australians not helping us? When the Japanese invaded, they did help us. Why, they ask, are the Portuguese not helping us? We're still a Portuguese colony. Who, they ask, will pay for the terrible damage to our homes? My main answer was that Australia would not send forces here. That's impossible. However, I said we could ask that Australia raise this fighting at the United Nations. That was possible. At that, the second in charge rose to his feet, exclaimed, "Camarada journalist," shook my hand, the rest shook my hand, and we were applauded because we are Australians. That's all they want, for the United Nations to care about what is happening here.
And that was Greg Shackleton. He ended by saying he was reporting from a place he would not forget in Timor. And it was a report that Australians, right, would never forget because he and his crew were executed by the Indonesian military.
Well, I don't use the word executed to suggest that there was some sort of formal trial. They were just shot. These guys were cowboys. I mean, they were dressed as civilians. They just walked through into the village. The journalists came out with their hands up, and they just shot them. They kept a couple and tortured them, I believe, but we haven't any real evidence, but there's a lot of eyewitnesses who have assured us that that is what happened.
Greg's mother committed suicide a few years later.
She did, yes. Not because of the murders, but because the Australian government did absolutely nothing, and I would have to say still have really done nothing of any value.
Although later they signed the Timor Gap Treaty, dividing up Timor's oil between Australia and Indonesia. Perhaps that was one of the motivations for not criticizing Indonesia.
They're only interested in market share, as all Western documentaries are interested in market share in Indonesia. They don't care what happens anywhere else.
200,000 Timorese died over the next quarter of a century. John Miller, on this report, what role has the U.S. played in the issue of accountability?
Well, the Truth Commission recommended that the U.S., Australia, other governments that backed Indonesia, and the weapons companies that profited from selling the weapons that killed so many Timorese, killed the Australian journalists.
90% of the weapons used in the invasion were from the United States. Right,
that they should pay reparations to the Timorese, and that these countries in Australia and the U.S. are now stepping up their military assistance in the name of countering the war on, prosecuting the war on terror, that governments not supply Indonesia with weapons and training until the military is totally reformed and until it proves it can respect human rights. And one way to show that it respects human rights is to let its generals and former generals be tried for the war crimes they committed in East Timor.
President Bush is visiting Indonesia.
Right, he's making a second visit this month after he goes to the APEC conference. And we're going to be pressing him not to offer more weapons and training when he goes there.
Protests planned by Indonesians?
Yeah, I think they've already started. A historic garden is being destroyed in Bogor, where the meeting's going to take place to accommodate his helicopter. And it'll be one of these very, like his last visit, a very quick one. I think it's only supposed to last 8 or 10 hours. And, you know, and it'll be another way for the U.S. to signal to Indonesia that, business as usual has come again, and that the U.S. fully backs the Indonesian government and the Indonesian military.
Do you ever see an international war crimes tribunal or a Timor war crimes tribunal taking place as a result of the 200,000 people being killed?
It will take time. The Timorese government is very afraid to press for this because they need good relations with Indonesia. Indonesia has shown what kind of damage it can do to East Timor if it wants. But the East Timorese people continue to want it, and I think recent events, the recent crisis in East Timor, shows why it's necessary to enable the East Timorese to have some kind of closure and put the past behind them. And I think the Indonesians need it, and I think our own country needs it as well.
Shirley Shackleton, we'll end with you. Though it was your husband that was killed in 1975, you took up the cause of all of the Timorese and have become, in Australia, a well-known East Timor activist. Do you feel that people understand what took place?
No, not really, because millions of rupiah have been spent to tell lies to make it look as though Indonesia had to do what they had to do. Nevertheless, you just keep trying. You just mustn't give up. I have to say that
and you know,
on the day that INTERFET went in, that was the Australian military went in, people that I knew had actively criticised me. They just rushed me when I went down the street to the grocery shop. I had people giving me flowers and kissing me. I mean, they completely changed their view. It shows if you start to win, you're a winner. It was extraordinary. And I think the fact that so many hundreds of thousands of people got out on the streets demanding that Australia go in, it shows that all those years, they knew that what we were saying was right.
And
they couldn't prove it.
The person in charge of the operation that killed your husband, Greg?
Yunus Josvia, yes.
His position? In Indonesia. He became the Minister of Information.
Oh, he got promoted. He's a hero. He's a very rich man now.
We're going to leave it there. Shirley Shackleton, her husband, Greg Shackleton, killed October 1975. John Miller, national coordinator of the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network. Tonight we'll be at Judson Church in New York at 7 o'clock. Shirley Shackleton will be talking about her experiences. I'll also be talking about the massacre in East Timor on this 15th anniversary. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Matei, Lee Burek, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. Special thanks to Megan Whitney, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Tyshawn Black, Jerome Bourgeois, Angela Alston, Uri Galed, Samantha Chamblay, Megan Whitney. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.